figured out. For those litigants who have traveled here, we appreciate your flexibility. I hope it was not begrudging, but it is very helpful for the court, and I hope for the law students to come up here periodically, as we have. Been 3 years since we were last here. Welcome all the students who are here. Hope we don't persuade any of you, either the judges or the advocates, not to become lawyers as a result of what you see and hear in here today. But we have very good advocacy at the Fifth Circuit, and I'm sure the group here today will hold up that reputation of the court and of the advocates. We have three argued cases today. The first one that I now call is Mark Moody versus Bobby Lumpkin, 19-11200. Mr. Hooks.
Good morning. We have a case that involves the remedy of the habeas review and the limits of what habeas corpus review should be. As you know, since you had us just 2 weeks ago brief the Ramirez case, and I want to start sort of there at the Ramirez case, might be a good place. They deal with the issue about whether habeas.
Mr. Hooks, just to give us a little background, of course your claim is that there's a right in state court proceedings to counsel in a form of post-conviction relief, habeas proceeding in state court, right to counsel. Your client did not file a direct appeal from his plea agreement. Why could he not have asserted ineffective assistance of trial counsel had he filed a direct appeal?
He didn't have knowledge that his attorney had been below the normal standard of representation. And Ramirez.
Okay, well, let me start again. Is there some procedural rule in Texas that does not permit you to assert ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
No.
All right, thank you.
His reasoning would be that he was unable to find out that his attorney had failed to do certain things, and that he didn't have the knowledge that this enhancement, which we're dealing just strictly with sentencing and the enhancement that he was unaware of and claims to this day that his counsel never counseled him about, caused him a few more years in prison. And from the Ramirez case, I get that it's an extreme remedy to start allowing just people all over the place to start filing petitions in federal court for malfunctions that they experience in court back in Texas or wherever. I think that the line is drawn at where they say it's an extraordinary remedy that's used only in extreme circumstances. And from my reading of Strickland, it seems that an extreme circumstance is one that involves a constitutional issue, because that's competence is fundamental, and the fundamental word comes up in all this law as well. So a fundamental right to not necessarily effective counsel in the sense of, you know, the guy got me off, but counsel that's at least doing diligent work to find out that you have a prior that's going to enhance your sentence. I'll candidly admit to the court that we would have to, I suspect, gather more evidence. He'd have to go back and get an affidavit, but that's a pretty, I mean, I've signed many of those affidavits myself, filled them out myself, and other cases by other attorneys have asked me to submit something like that. And I don't think it would cost that much time, even though this is, you know, it is costly, but it's a pretty simple, you know, yes or no from the attorney. I should say that also, I don't know if you paid particular attention to the history of this case. He, in the case that brought about this enhancement back in, I think it was 1998, that case is what came back into his life on the more current case in 2015. That's the case that caused him the enhancement. That's the case he had no counsel on. That's the case he was rushed through the jail docket. That's his characterization of it. Obviously wasn't there. But he says that he was told, quote, you know, this is in all his papers that he signed with his court, is that sign here and go home today. That's the language that they use on the jail docket quite often. I know from my own personal experience. I don't want to impugn the you know, the bar, but I know that there's a certain rush when they're doing all the pleas on Friday afternoon or whatever, and so there's a lot of carelessness that goes on there, and they don't tell you things.
Just like, for context, this man has how many actual DWI convictions in Texas?
I think two.
Just two. Mm-hmm. The first is the 1998 predicate, and then the second is the 2015 guilty plea.
Right.
Wasn't there one in 1995?
I don't recall seeing that. There may be.
Okay, and the...
No, I'm sorry, 1994.
But the 1998 one is the one that his guilty plea, his attorney allegedly advised him to take the plea in 2015.
No, that's the 2015.
The 2015, the attorney advises him to take it to avoid a habitual mandatory minimum of 25 years. Instead, he gets 20 for a third DWI.
Right.
That would be his third. He gets 20 years.
Right.
And his allegation is that even though he signed waiver of counsel for the 1998 predicate, he didn't really pay attention to the signature? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yes. It seems I recall looking through the record on that case, and a lot of times, again, it's Friday, they want to go home, and there's like nothing filled out. There's no boxes checked a lot of times on these documents, so it's just real clear that it's just a very... careless procedure occasionally at that level, and it ends up in things like this.
Well, remind me, what's the ineffectiveness?
Well, he didn't have counsel.
The ineffectiveness is that he didn't, even though he waived it.
That's the 1998 case. Now, the ineffectiveness here is that he says his lawyer never knew about this case, had never researched it, which gets back to where I was going with Strickland, was to say the standard of care for effective lawyering is... not something that...
But he did introduce at state court, there's been an introduction of the letter from his attorney saying, well, I saw the waiver, correct?
Yeah, in general terms about just the plea back in 1998. He's saying he didn't tell... My client is saying, my attorney in 2015, Mr. Bush, I believe, did not inform me that this enhancement was going to be clicked in.
Now, the district court doesn't get to any of this because the district court applies the AEDPA timing rule. It's too late.
Right.
And your argument against that relies on what best authority?
Well, just the language from the Ramirez case, that extreme malfunctions, which I interpret as constitutional malfunctions, effective counsel is about as extreme as it gets. It's fundamental to the system. So that would be his way of getting around it in this case.
So it's not an extension of Martinez that you're pressing?
It is a bit. Let me take a second to kind of scroll up to Martinez real quickly because I was just looking at it. And they, by the way, all point out that, they're intruding. We understand that this is an intrusion into state court sovereignty, but again, we're dealing with the constitutional issue now. We're dealing with whether he got effective counsel. And I think that's what erases the boundary for my client, that, this is not just any old type of ineffective counsel. This is one that is rooted in the Constitution. So just as I pass through, I noticed that. I want to point that out. And actually, I believe the Hughes v. Vanoy case that I cited in my case says, I think maybe their language was a fundamental constitutional right that can be upheld, as in this case, in no other way. If again, I know it seems kind of trivial because almost he's out of prison now, for one thing, but so the whole thing seems not so significant. But just as a general way of interpreting the Constitution and what our guides are as lawyers and legal scholars, et cetera, is to always take every instance to analyze what's the biggest issue, even though it may, we may be bending a lot of small rules, and I think that's what they're suggesting in Ramirez.
But if you could just get, you were going to peek down, you were just going to explain how it is that Martinez abrogates the statutory time limits. What's the argument that we can disregard what Congress has said about the amount of time it can pass?
Because that's why I'm bringing up that, because this is an extreme malfunction. That's the language that they're all using. That the federal courts have the last say, not the state courts.
You know, the whole point of ADPA was for finality, comity, et cetera. And the argument you're making is that anyone in prison seeking habeas relief in federal court 10, 20 years after the time to the 1 year period for seeking habeas relief is lapsed could say, well, I've just now realized that this malfunction happened or that malfunction happened, therefore I need to get habeas relief. I mean, that's the extent of your argument.
Yes, I guess that's sort of the Scalia, all the, you know, the first, I can't remember which case it was, but, you know, in one of these cases that we all reviewed, we had the disappointed segment of court that was unhappy with that result, and they, you know, expressed
you've
just what you
that,
said.
You mentioned that your client is no longer incarcerated. Is he under supervised release?
Yes, yes.
How many years?
Oh, he's got a bunch. It's like 25 years.
Supervised release.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. 20 or 25, I can't remember. It was a lot. He told me the other day.
All right, Kelly. Anything else for us?
I believe so. I've just got it. I think we've.
I wanted to ask you, you didn't file a reply brief, and the state makes some pretty strong arguments about your case, including that we should, in the alternative, just go ahead and rule it was not ineffective assistance of trial counsel. What was your thinking behind not filing a reply brief?
I'm not sure I understood your question.
Well, you didn't file a reply brief.
Right.
Why?
I was focused on this as being, and I think I was also still absorbing everything, and I think still reading cases, and I think this case, I think, has put me in a different position than I was in 6 months ago. This case is 14, 15 months old.
Thank you.
Mr. Hooks, you want to do rebuttal? Hang on just a moment.
Of course.
Thank you. We're set up a little differently here. Throws people off. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. We think the district court correctly dismissed this petition as untimely under the 1 year time bar. There are really only two points I'd like to make today on the certificate of appealability issues on the constitutional question. There is binding Fifth Circuit precedent that forecloses the type of relief Mr. Hooks just advocated for today. Notwithstanding Martinez, that Fifth Circuit precedent that predates that, still on the books and still binding on this court. And on the equitable question, as we pointed out in our 28J, or the response to the court's instruction to file briefing on Shin versus Ramirez, that recent case illustrates that Martinez is not supposed to be expanded beyond the very narrow exception for procedural default that the Supreme Court recognized in that case. And as I believe my friend on the other side did acknowledge today, what Mr. Moody needs in order to move forward in this case is, at a minimum, some form of extension of Martinez. I think that's beyond reasonable debate at this point. I'm happy to take the court's questions on any of the topics we briefed, including some of the background about Mr. Moody's specific convictions, because I think the colloquy that happened earlier was not entirely accurate based on the record, based on the number of convictions, things like that. Happy to discuss that, but otherwise I'll start with the constitutional question on that certificate of appealability.
Why don't you go ahead in the direction you want to go.
Thank you. As I mentioned in my opening, the binding Fifth Circuit precedent that we've identified in the briefing would be Elizalde versus Dretke, that had taken up a similar question of whether there should be a purported exception to the blanket Finley rule, which is generally there is no constitutional right to post-conviction habeas counsel. So that's the general rule. And there had been a series of cases before Elizalde. There was a case called Martinez and another case called Beasley. Prisoners had been trying to argue that there should be some constitutional right in post-conviction habeas proceedings, or at least some sort of exception to the general rule. And as Martinez and Elizalde had explained, there is no constitutional right to effective state habeas counsel to present an IATC claim, even though the allegation had been by the prisoners that the state habeas application presented the prisoner's first opportunity to make a claim of ineffective assistance. We would argue that the rule of orderliness continues
but,
to...
But this isn't the first opportunity to present ineffective assistance of trial counsel, is it, on state post-conviction relief? He could have done it on direct appeal.
Judge Barksdale, this particular defendant did plead guilty, and as part of his particular guilty plea had entered a waiver of various rights, and one of them was a waiver of a right to appeal. I understand this to be somewhat
So that's routine. An entirely different claim. I guess now you could file for, my counsel didn't advise me correctly on signing the waiver of appeal.
Well, I think there are a lot of things about this case that illustrate the kind of can of worms the court would be opening if it were to recognize this novel constitutional right to post-conviction appeal. One would be exactly what Mr. Moody tried to do, which was to raise a claim in state habeas proceedings attacking the very same 1998 drunk driving conviction that he's ultimately complaining about, the 1998 one, right? The state court of appeals reviews the state habeas trial findings, rejecting that claim, and then the prisoner will try to come to federal court and repackage virtually the same claim just through the lens of ineffective assistance. Also point out, as the U.S. Supreme Court's oral argument in Martinez case itself illustrated, you get into these weird problems when you recognize a constitutional right to state habeas. It's sort of an infinite habeas problem because you can always complain that somebody before you did something ineffectively and keep either running the clock or prolonging the post-conviction review process. So the point I would make on the Martinez question right now, moving, unless there are any further questions about the constitutional question, this is the separate equitable argument.
Well, you mean the tolling question?
Equitable tolling. No, Your Honor. So Mr. Moody does not have a certificate of appealability on equitable tolling, and that was correctly rejected. I'm talking about the Martinez equitable exception rule that the court recently discussed in Shin.
Yeah. Well, before you get to Shin and what evidence can be taken, is the essence of his factual narrative that he gets caught for driving while intoxicated in 2015. He gets counsel appointed. The counsel says, tells him, take a plea to 20 years because you've got a 1998 conviction. But that counsel doesn't really look and see that the 98 conviction's actually vulnerable. This is his argument, I think. Same counsel says to him, and by the way, in the guilty plea agreement, waive your right to appeal. So the same counsel that doesn't do the investigation to the predicate that gets him 20 years also tells him to take a plea he can't go on direct appeal. Then, correct me if any of these are wrong, then he gets to Texas post-conviction proceedings, but he's not entitled to counsel. So in a sense, he really has never been able to say, I had terrible counsel that committed to me to 20 years and protected himself because I can't appeal. So in that, that's the essence of his argument. Then he gets into federal court finally has court-appointed counsel, and he wants to bring up ineffectiveness of counsel. And the Fifth Circuit case that says to us that's not permissible, the 2 years that has elapsed, he has no chance, is which? What case?
So there are a couple of things to unpack there, right? So if we were looking to a Fifth Circuit case, it'd have to be one that actually addressed that factual scenario. That factual scenario is not, it's not what happened here.
Okay.
To start with the factual problems there, I think you could look at page 44 of the record. This was the letter exchanged between Mr. Moody and his 2015 trial lawyer that within days, I think about 2 weeks of Mr. Moody's 2015 guilty plea, when that conviction becomes final for our present purposes, there's a letter exchange that explains Mr. Moody is complaining about this 1998 conviction. The timeline of what happened just does not reflect, I think, the way Your Honor described it. But the most important thing about this letter that jumps out to me is this distinction between something that is void versus voidable. When you're complaining that you didn't have counsel when you enter a guilty plea, I think as the letter correctly points out, when there appears on the face of the record that you did in fact sign the waiver of counsel that accompanies your guilty plea, a presumption of regularity attaches to that. And once you start to try to challenge that, it becomes exceedingly difficult. And the case I would point the court to on that is Mallard versus Kane.
Right, so there's no clear and convincing evidence that he didn't waive counsel, but I'm asking you to assume that actually there was a defect to the 1998 predicate. But a Texas lawyer pushes him through the 2015 guilty plea, gets an appeal waiver, still no relief in federal habeas?
So a couple answers. One, part of it is sort of sounds in this nature of, fairness. Is there some procedure where a prisoner who thinks I haven't gotten counsel, that I've pleaded guilty, what can he do? Well, we know, and I apologize, this is just sort of a general matter, not specific to any issue in the briefing, so I'm going
a
little
bit helpful,
far.
And I agree, these are not the facts.
I'm going a little far afield, but if the court will indulge me a minute. The way the process is supposed to work is that in a post-conviction proceeding, the prisoner, and he can do this pro se, there's nothing wrong about being pro se, he can tell the state habeas court in a state habeas application, he can simply say, well, sure, I executed a guilty plea, but I didn't really have counsel.
Right.
Now, when he does that, the way it's supposed to work is the State Court of Criminal Appeals can say, well, it looks like there's a fact issue. We're going to send this to the state habeas trial court, which is usually the court of conviction, to enter findings. And the CCA will simply instruct, well, let's have some findings. What did you do? How did you admonish him? All of the sort of things you'd expect if it's really missing from the record. And then there'll be findings and they can be reviewed, right? So there is a process for people who feel that their rights to counsel were not properly vetted before they entered a waiver. We don't have that in this case. What we do have is based on the timing of this letter alone, I mean, Mr. Moody knows what he was convicted of. He knew the factual basis for his 1998 guilty plea. I mean, he remembers what did or didn't happen when he went in front of that judge and pleaded guilty. But as he would later tell the Court of Criminal Appeals, this is page 134 of the record, he admits, I can't prove I was never offered counsel that day. He can't prove that he signed the waiver of attorney after I pled guilty. This is in the nature of one of those really insurmountable problems that we can't blame a lawyer in 2015 under any stretch of the Strickland prejudice standard that would apply. Because recall, even if the court were to extend Martinez in the way that Shin versus Ramirez has said not to, you'd still have to show that your 2015 lawyer was ineffective within the meaning of Strickland. And one of the things you have to show is some reasonable probability that the Court of Criminal Appeals, had it been presented with this counseled state habeas application, was going to grant you relief. Well, that material, that sort of evidence argument has never materialized. And I think in light of some of the concessions Mr. Moody had made in earlier stages of his proceedings, and what appear to be misunderstandings of the law regarding the waiver of counsel, that probability would never materialize. So unless there are any further questions, we just ask the court to affirm.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have time for rebuttal.
Extremely brief. Just to reiterate that it seems at this point in this case, we're sort of at a policy place where we need to deal with what these recent cases seem to be saying is a direction that the Supreme Court wants to go. And I think that is the very specific definition of what we're dealing with is constitutional questions that should get this treatment in the process. I think that limits it quite a bit as far as the concern that the court has, which I admittedly don't know much about how many cases there are going through the Supreme Court along these lines and how much more it's going to go. I don't know any statistics to give the court about how much we would be increasing their burden. But it does seem like we do have a genuine constitutional right to counsel, and it seems like the criminal justice system is one of the few ways you can improve the criminal justice system is to enforce the Constitution generously in cases where it should be construed generously toward the population. It's our goal in justice is not money. It's not about saving money. It's about giving the best system we can give people, even though it's, as we all know, extremely complex and messy. And you know, from 1998 to 2015 to 2023, you know, so I get that. But I think that's a bigger issue than you can get just by hearing facts or accusations against defendants that they themselves weren't very careful. They didn't do all the things they could have done for themselves. That's putting the burden somewhere else. So that's what I hope the court will consider is the overall need for the system to go this direction.
Thank you. Mr. Hooks, this case started in the Fifth Circuit pro se. We granted a right of appeal on certain issues, sought counsel to be appointed. You agreed to be appointed. We appreciate your assistance on this case. You came into it late, and we have benefited by your participation. Thank you
very much.
And to both sides for being here today.